From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the controversial conservative pastor Scott Lively. He'll be challenging Governor Charlie Baker in the Massachusetts Republican gubernatorial primary.
I'm here to represent the full-spectrum conservative perspective of republicanism. I don't need a teleprompter. I don't need notes because I know what I believe in.
And Massachusetts Transportation Secretary Stephanie Pollack says that if Alston wants West Station, someone's got to pay for it.
The station is not currently programmed in either capital plan for the next 5 years.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. A surprise coming out of this weekend's Massachusetts Republican State Convention. Governor Charlie Baker won the endorsement of the convention with just under 70% of the vote. But Baker will be facing a challenger in the state GOP primary. That's because conservative Springfield pastor Scott Lively received nearly 28% of the vote, well over the 15% needed to advance to the primary. Now, Lively is a controversial pastor, known widely for his anti-gay rhetoric. At the convention, though, he positioned himself as what he called the true conservative versus Baker's more moderate republicanism.
I'm 100% pro-life. I'm 100% pro-Second Amendment. I stand on the original intent of the Constitution. I'm 100% pro-Trump.
And Scott Lively, in fact, seemed to take a page from the Trump campaign rally playbook when he called for a delegate to be removed from the convention.
I was born in 1957. And when I was born, This is the problem with letting Democrats in the Republican Party. See? They don't let people... Would security remove this person? Right. I'm not going to be heckled during my speech.
Security did not remove the delegate. So what kind of message is Lively's candidacy sending to the Mass GOP and the state as a whole? Well, Scott Lively joins us now. Mr. Lively, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be with you.
Well, so first of all, I just want to ask you, I mean, you said this weekend at the Mass GOP convention that you stand for conservative values in the Bay State. But I'm wondering, I was looking back over your career and your history, and in 1992, you were found guilty of battery in an Oregon court where you were living and working with a conservative Christian group at the time. And that's because in 1991, there was this incident where a 23-year-old freelance photographer named Catherine Stouffer attended a meeting of the Oregon Citizens Alliance with whom you were working. And you threw her against the wall, dragged her across the floor. She sued, and a Multnomah County jury found you guilty of battery and awarded Stouffer $31,000 in damages, including $20,000 in pain and suffering. So if you stand for conservative values that put women and family at the front as primary, but you assaulted a 23-year-old back in 1991, I mean, why should Massachusetts Republicans vote for you?
Wow, that was quite an opening. I didn't realize you guys were quite so predatory. But
these
anyway,
are facts that we
on several points.
Well, we have the court documents, sir, so
no,
it's not predatory. It's not predatory.
No.
It's straight from Oregon
predatory.
State court.
It's predatory. You asked me to come on the show and pretended like you're actually interested in my views, and that's fine. I don't mind answering any questions.
It is not predatory, sir. You are running. You are running for to be the chief executive of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and you say you're running on conservative values. So I'm just wondering how your own past history.
To respond
indeed,
to your allegations?
But I'm just. I don't want anyone to think we're being predatory when we're simply asking you to respond to your own record.
They can hear it. People have ears. This is called a gotcha interview.
It's right? A gotcha with your own record. I'm just wondering if you have an answer.
Actually, that's not my record. And if you give me a chance to actually respond to the allegations, you'll have an opportunity to hear that.
Go ahead.
Okay. First of all, I was not found guilty. I was found liable because there's a big difference. I'm an attorney myself, and actually I became an attorney because of what I experienced during that outrageous abuse of the judicial system in Multnomah County, Oregon. When a guilty is a criminal verdict, liable is what you're found if a, in a civil case when a jury agrees with the arguments of the plaintiff and not the defendant. And the case at issue was an extraordinarily political case in which the judge actually happened to be a corporate attorney for an organization that was funding the opposition in a ballot measure campaign in which I was the spokesman.
This was a jury trial. It was a civil trial, and it was a jury trial, though.
It was a jury trial, but it was a jury trial with a judge who was on the other side.
The jury deliberated for about 12 hours and came back as found you being liable for this battery, and they awarded this $31,000 settlement or award to the plaintiff.
Right.
You paid a lot of it, though. You paid at least $16,000 of it.
And if you had been in the courtroom, you would have actually seen that that judge, when my attorney attempted to introduce Catherine Stauffer's admission that she was criminally trespassing to the assistant district attorney, when he attempted to introduce that into evidence, as was our right to do, which was exculpatory evidence, which would have changed the entire result, that judge made the jurors leave the courtroom. And then he threatened my attorney, who was his first case out of law school, with sanctions if he proceeded any further, which was our absolute constitutional right to do. But that's what the judge did. And so the jury never actually got to hear that Catherine Stauffer was the one who was guilty, not me.
So are you saying that you didn't assault her? Are you saying that you didn't throw her against a wall and drag her across the floor?
Exactly. That was all made up. She was a journalist for Just Out magazine and a member of the political opposition during a ballot measure campaign on LGBT issues in Oregon.
Then why did you pay the $16,000 in damages? Why did you pay? Why didn't you countersue?
Well, the reason that I paid is because I wasn't going to be able to get a law license after going to law school. I went to law school because of what I experienced in that case. I was never going to let that happen again. Most outrageous abuse of judicial authority. It was completely political. It was all about ballot measure 9. And I was stuck. What can you do when you have a corrupt judge and when the media won't report the facts about the corruption of the judge because they want to get you because you're against their ideology?
But since you say you do have a law degree now, I mean, I didn't imagine spending so much time on this, but this is interesting. I mean, why didn't you countersue? It seems as if what you're saying is true, you had the grounds for a mistrial and yet you didn't pursue that.
Well, when you are in a system that is as corrupt as Multnomah County, it's sort of like being under the Soviets. When the Soviets would find you guilty, there may have been, even in the Soviet Union, there were procedures that you could follow, you know, to sort of get an appeal. But everybody knew it was just as ridiculous to even try because the entire system was rigged. And that's what it was in Multnomah County in 1992.
So just let me get this clear.
You're nailed for something I didn't do. And I was, and you know what? During this whole thing, this was a complete setup. This case, the incident happened like over a year before, but they intentionally postponed it until just before the election, so they could turn it into a show trial to influence the vote on ballot measure 9. And they characterized me on the evening news every night as somebody who was like a Nazi and the Ku Klux Klan. And it was all about destroying the credibility of our ballot measure campaign.
So it really must have hurt to be equated to Nazis.
That's one of the reasons why I wrote the pink swastika, because the accusations that were being leveled against people just simply because we said that we don't agree with special rights for people based on sexual orientation. So they started saying, because of that, anyone who opposes special rights for homosexuals is like the Nazis. And so there I was in my, this is after this happened, but in, into my office comes a guy with a sheaf of documentation, and he said, you know, they got it completely backwards, right? That the Nazis weren't, you know, they, yeah, there was some anti-gay stuff, but the Nazis were filled with homosexuals. And,
so,
and then he showed me the documentation, and I said, this is outrageous. So later on, I responded to it by showing that the arguments that they were making, the attacks they were making against me, were just simply not true, and the documentation proved my position and disproved theirs.
So I just want to get a couple of things clear. Are you equating to a United States court of law, this is Multnomah County, an Oregon County court, as being equivalent or worse than a Soviet court?
Well, you know, that's, I'm just saying that's the way the Soviet system worked.
But yeah, we're talking about a state in the United States of America.
I know. America. And have you really haven't seen, don't know much about Oregon, do you?
I actually grew up in Oregon. I lived there from
really?
The time I was
Where?
2 to the time
Where?
I was 23, in Corvallis, from? Oregon, in fact. And I know you
Corvallis.
Spend a lot of time
yeah.
in Eugene, Oregon, so I know Multnomah County very well.
I would have pegged you as a Eugenie. In a heartbeat.
Actually, I said Corvallis, sir. I said
yeah,
Corvallis.
I know, but they border, and it's really the same ultra leftist crowd. That's actually Antifa has its deepest roots in that exact area. You know, there were actually people when I used to go down to Lane County. They were actually people, black clad Antifa types, hanging out in front of the police station with signs that say "Kill the police." That was all the way back. Shoot, that was back in the 90s, long before they showed up going after Donald Trump and things.
So you come from an
interesting background that explains why you conduct your interview the way you do.
I suppose I want to get back to something that that you were saying about.
You do.
About why you wrote the Pink Swastika, right? So this is the book that you co-authored with Kevin Abrams, and I have a fourth edition with me from 2001, where you say in the section preliminaries that, quote, "We were scrupulous in our documentation of homosexuals as the true inventors of Nazism and the guiding force behind many Nazi atrocities." So, I mean, at the convention this weekend,
did you do any fact checking on the documentation?
Well, I have your book.
I know, but did you do any fact checking on the documentation?
Well, I guess what I'm asking more is that
you're a journalist. And you've read a document that is filled with citations to sources regarding assertions that are highly controversial. Did you actually do any investigation to determine if the facts that I'm arguing are true?
It's the conclusions more that I'm curious
you're
about.
You're the journalist. You're an investigative journalist. You have a responsibility. If you're going to have a subject come on your show and start attacking them, to actually look and see if the things that they said are actually factually true. Right? Don't attack the premise. You've got the book in your hand.
Well, it's the
You've
conclusion.
Got the citation.
It is the conclusion
want,
that I'm
you
I'm asking
go,
you about
you don't
because
want to talk about at, the, you don't want to talk about the documentation, because if you talk about the documentation, then you'll have to admit that facts are true that contradict your ideology. Right? You want to talk about the premise, the idea that homosexuals couldn't have been. It's so ridiculous.
I'm actually asking you about what you wrote, simply.
Yeah, I know.
But you're not answering.
Asking,
I haven't even had a chance to ask you a question. Because the question has to do with the fact that you want to represent Massachusetts as governor of the state of Massachusetts. And this weekend in Worcester, you actually talked about how you have bridges to mend. Those are your words with the LGBTQ community. So I want to just play what you said this weekend in Worcester.
On the LGBT issues, I have some fence mending that I need to do with people in the LGBT community. Mea culpa. I have overstated some things. Not so much in my writings. I can defend just about anything I've written. But sometimes giving a speech, especially with when you're under siege like I have been, and there's really, and the media is only looking at you and not fact-checking the other side too, sometimes you sort of fall into hyperbole, and I'm guilty of some hyperbole.
So, Mr. Lively, I'm just wondering, when in your book, when you wrote in their quest for power, Nazi homosexuals were no different from today's gays, is that one of the hyperboles you were referencing?
Not in the context that it's in. The hyperbole that I was referencing, they were quoting, I think, and I'm not even sure exactly what I said, but I did an interview with the guy in the Boston Globe about it, and he was quoting it, and I challenged him. He couldn't come up with the source. But anyway, what if that is exactly what I said? The hyperbole was, so the sentence was sort of like, everything that you think about when you think about Nazis comes out of the German gay subculture, something like that. And the hyperbole was to say everything instead of some things or many things, because the actual documented fact, which you have in your hand, see, you're culpable now. You're responsible to tell the truth because you're holding the book in your hand that actually cites the sources. In fact, 25% of the sources in the book that you're holding in your hand are gay sources, right? So the real issue, the real conversation we should be having is whether the things that I've asserted, the specific facts that I've asserted, not the sort of generalized, you know, summaries, but the actual specific facts. Is any of my book true? Can you answer that? Is any of the book true?
Well, you know what? In good faith, what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at all those sources that you cited, and between now and September, we'll have multiple opportunities to talk about it. So I'll right. do that, and let's come back to that conversation. But I just right. want to ask you one last question. Back to the beginning here. Why is it that you think you are the best Republican candidate for the office of governor for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts?
Because I'm a man who can stand on his principles against the worst possible attacks that a person can go through and not be stampeded away from the things that he believes or be intimidated or compromise against his values, and frankly, that's the kind of person that we need, who's standing in the seat, in the platform of the governor, because all the Republicans that have come before are people that are so intimidated by people like you that they will cave on Republican values and pander to the Democrats out of fear of being treated like you've been treating me on this interview. See, I'm able, because of all the things I've been through, to be able to take everything that you've got and respond with fact, with reason, without losing my temper, and without hating you. Right? I don't hate you. I don't have any ill will toward you. I can treat you like a human being and care about you, even though you're doing what you're doing. And that's the kind of person we need in the seat. Now, you may not agree with me on some of these things, and frankly, I am my personality, my profile, the things I'm interested in, my skills that I have, are so much broader than this tiny little narrow issue about LGBT. I mean, there's how much of what we deal with in Massachusetts really revolves around the LGBT agenda? It's a tiny fraction of 1%, but we're dealing with the rest, the other 99.999. is stuff that we could probably agree on most of it.
Hmm.
And I think if you have a list, if you listen to the way that I would approach those issues, that you would actually agree with me on most of the things that I say, even though you're a progressive on the other side.
Well, I don't think that we should be. Look, I'm not. I'm only taking the sides of what the record says, and so that's why I asked you the question.
No,
the questions
you're,
that I did. But with
not,
but with all you, with all due you, respect, Mr. Lively, I just let you.
Show.
I let you. You slandered my character left and right, and it's okay. I know that's what happens in politics.
You made presumptions about who
I am based on the fact that I grew up in Corvallis, Oregon. But my point is I actually appreciate. I appreciate this conversation. I appreciate this conversation. And I made a promise to you about checking your sources in your book and having multiple conversations with you between now and the primary in September, and also about the other issues as well. So I make that commitment to you. I'd love to talk to you a couple more times, but at this point in time, I'm afraid we've actually gone several minutes over our allotted time here. So I just want to say, Scott Lively, who is a Republican candidate for governor in Massachusetts, thank you so much for joining me.
Well, and thank you for having me on, and I look forward to many enjoyable conversations in the future.
Thank you again. Okay, well, so we did reach out to the re-election campaign of Governor Charlie Baker. They said neither the governor or anyone from the campaign could join us today, but they did refer us back to the statement that the governor made during the convention to reporters. So here's what Governor Baker had to say.
Look, I can't get in the minds of people who made decisions to support us or to support anybody else. But I can tell you that Scott Lively, a lot of what he says, a lot of what he believes doesn't belong in public discourse.
All right. Well, let's hear from a Baker delegate. Ed Lyons joins us via Skype. He's a Massachusetts Republican activist, a political writer, and he was a GOP convention delegate this weekend from Swampscott. And he's also a frequent contributor to us here at Radio Boston. Ed, good to have you back.
Good morning, Vietnam.
So what do you think the message is that's being sent to the Mass GOP as a whole, that Scott Lively got, more than about 28% of the vote here this weekend?
I think a lot of people in the party, although a minority, are frustrated with the reality of governing this state and believed in kind of the fantasy that Dr. Lively gave about conservative principles being applied to our state government. I think that most of the people who voted for him were not bigots until that moment. And I think a lot of people are just sort of, tired of compromising. I think that probably a minority of the delegates who voted for Dr. Lively could be called supporters of his. And most people who voted did not vote for him. I think only several hundred delegates voted for him. I imagine that number would be lower today if they listened to Radio Boston.
So, ostensibly between now and September, Governor Baker, factually, he is going to have to be running against Scott Lively now. Perhaps there'll be some debates. Who knows? I mean, is there the underlying concerns that you were talking about that some massive GOP delegates may have had, which is why they cast their vote for Lively? I mean, those concerns are going to get an airing, and they should, shouldn't they?
Sure. I mean, Governor Baker won the 2014 primary with 75% of the vote. He will probably win the 2018 primary with far more because people will feel, the need to support him. He's very popular in the party. There is a small group of people in the party who are just frustrated with the fact that Baker cannot sound like the people on Fox News. It's not a new message. It's a persistent message. There are people who, want the party and our representatives to be authentically conservative and to not compromise at all with anyone else in the state. That will not win statewide, will not win for federal races. And so we keep hearing from them. So, and we're going to keep hearing that message. But really, most of the party understands that a man like Charlie Baker is who should be governing the state, and he's doing a great job.
Hmm. Now, you wrote over the weekend that you're concerned, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you're concerned with some of the aspects of the platform that the Republican Party laid out this weekend. Is that right?
Sure. So we write a platform every 4 years, but no one notices it because we don't use it for anything. It sort of reflects, a bunch of things, grievances amongst different subgroups in the party, standard Republican themes, but we don't use it for anything. But I was distressed by the fact that it included a few things that, Dr. Lively would agree with.
Okay, so overall, Ed, I mean, obviously, we've still got several months between now and September. I'm just wondering what you see in the road ahead for the Mass GOP, because it seems like what happened in Worcester this weekend is actually significant, because it's an echo. It's a strong echo of the fact that a million Massachusetts voters in the 2016 election voted for Donald Trump.
Sure, but that doesn't mean they're going to vote for Dr. Lively at all. I mean, they're actually very, different people. I mean, one man talks a lot about the Ten Commandments. The other one breaks them all the time. I think that just because people are pro-Trump, they might have been, against Hillary Clinton. Dr. Lively ran as an independent last time and got 1% of the vote. People in the party don't know him. I don't think he'll be a factor at all. The pro-Trump wing of the GOP is there. Many of them don't like Governor Baker, but they the party likes Baker more than Trump. Polling shows that, you know, Baker is 10 to 15 points more popular than Trump. Polls that WBUR has sponsored. So, yes, people like Trump, but they like Baker a lot more. And the part of them that likes Trump is not going to get anyone else elected in the state, while the part of them that likes Baker will help, will get more people elected.
Mm. Well, Ed Lyons is a Massachusetts Republican activist. He's a political writer, and he was a GOP convention delegate in from Swampscott at the Worcester convention this weekend. He joined us via Skype today. Ed, thanks so much. Look forward to having you back as well.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, folks, let us know what you think. You can send me a tweet at Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Possibly the most famous Boston scientist you've never heard of is named Feng Zhang. By any measure, prizes, papers, and impact, Zhang is a science superstar, one of the most inventive life scientists in the world, and he's only 36.
Feng is a one-in-a-generation scientist who sees connections that the rest of us have overlooked.
Robert Desimone is director of the McGovern Institute for Brain Research at MIT.
And by seeing those new connections, he's able to make these gigantic new discoveries.
Those discoveries include work on two major advances, one in brain science and CRISPR, the breakthrough method for editing genes. For today's Common Health segment, WBUR's Kerry Goldberg introduces us to Feng Zhang, who is based at the Broad Institute at MIT and looks at the making of a scientist who wants to change the world.
When Feng Zhang was 11 years old, his parents, both computer scientists, decided the American style of education would work better for him than the schools in China. Less rote learning, more hands-on.
Because I like to take things apart and break things, it would be better for me to be in a system where I'm not so confined to a specific type of learning.
Zhang didn't speak any English when his mother first brought him to Des Moines, Iowa in 1993. But he quickly impressed Ed Pilkington, a former science teacher who coordinated the high school Gifted and Talented program. Zhang wasn't just intelligent. He had unstoppable drive.
And that's unique. I've seen students that test better than him. Not everybody is able to fail 20 experiments and then get up and then come up with something brilliant.
Zhang was soon ready for more than just classroom science. At age 16, he volunteered at a local gene therapy lab.
One of the very first experiments I did was to put a green fluorescent protein into a cell, and then the cell glowed green, and I thought that was magical.
That green glowing cell was part of the gene therapy lab's effort to find new treatments for cancer.
And so to realize that you can actually build biological things that can help people.
Yeah.
He would spend late hours in the lab, and just the light in his eyes when he would make a new discovery.
Zhang went to Harvard on full scholarship and then to Stanford for grad school, where he helped develop a brain science breakthrough, optogenetics, which lets researchers control neurons with light. MIT professor Ed Boyden recalls that the method was working in neurons in a dish. Then Zhang set out to make viruses that could deliver optogenetics into the brains of living mice, so that by using light to turn their neural circuits on and off, scientists could see how it affected their behavior. They could see what those circuits do.
And pretty soon he was putting these molecules into the living brain, and sure enough, it worked.
Feng looks around the natural world in a way that you might call almost childlike. He has kept the ability to be fascinated by everything.
Eric Lander is the director of the Broad Institute in Cambridge.
So when he looks at a new bacteria or some new biological process, he says, wow, that's so neat. How can I make use of that? How does it work? How might I deploy it?
And that's what Zhang did with CRISPR. He and others found a way to take a sort of a molecular scissors that existed in nature and engineer it into something incredibly useful to humans, a way to edit genes that's so much easier, it's like going from pen and paper to word processing. Other scientists worked on CRISPR as well, but in early 2013, Zhang published a pivotal paper showing how CRISPR could be developed to edit genes in animal and plant cells. Since then, CRISPR has swept thousands of labs around the world. It's turbocharging research on cancer and malaria and genetic diseases. Clinical trials that use CRISPR to correct genetic diseases are expected to begin this year.
So we're going to lab now, and this is where we do all of our experiments with cells and proteins and animals.
What are you working on right now?
Well, right now I was working on an experiment to be able to design a new piece of DNA so that we can introduce them into cells to be able to modify RNA.
Using CRISPR to edit RNA, a chemical cousin of DNA, opens up a huge new realm of possible uses in medicine. And it would help Zhang tackle brain disease, a top goal of his ever since he saw friends in college suffering from severe mental illness.
And it turns out that to correct the DNA in brain cells is fairly challenging. And so some of the recent work that we have been doing have been shifting away from DNA and moving into the RNA space.
With CRISPR expected to be worth billions to for-profit companies, Zhang, who's based at the Broad Institute and MIT, has been embroiled in a patent fight that's been called the Biotech Battle of the Century. It's an East Coast-West Coast conflict between the Broad and the University of California, Berkeley. Berkeley biologist Michael Eisen is definitely in the West Coast camp, but he gives Zhang kudos, if with a slight edge.
He's incredibly good at scouring the obscure literature in the field and finding little pieces of things that can help them and then pouncing on them. He's sort of brutally efficient almost.
But Zhang's work on CRISPR is a story of sharing as well as conflict. Through a local nonprofit, he has sent out the bits of DNA that other academic researchers need to work on CRISPR to more than 2,000 labs in 62 countries.
I think when I was growing up, my mother would always tell me you should try to do something that's useful and good for the world. And sharing is a way to be able to do good for the world.
That's also a lesson Zhang and his wife, Yufen Shi, who was a biomedical engineering grad student with him back at Stanford, teach their two young children. Share the toy.
Playing together, you can mutually enjoy the experience, and that really amplifies happiness everywhere.
Zhang wants to help more young scientists grow. He's been donating chunks of his prize money to groups that support science education. He's been awarded about $1.5 million in science prizes just over the last couple of years. That's more than a Nobel Prize would bring, and he's on many a shortlist for the Nobel as well. Broad Institute Director Eric Lander says if there's one key to Zhang's meteoric rise in science, it's that he's having fun.
The joy that comes from learning something about nature, that's why scientists do science. And Feng does that so obviously. You can see that joy in his face as he does it.
In the future, Lander says, he expects Zhang to find and develop more surprising systems like CRISPR, created by nature but holding great promise for humankind.
And that story from Carrie Goldberg, host of WBUR's Common Health blog. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The Masspike interchange in Alston is getting a makeover. The state's current proposal comes with a price tag of about $1 billion, and it includes, among other improvements, a brand new commuter rail stop called West Station. But there's a catch, because the state has proposed opening West Station by 2040. That's right. We're talking 22 years from now. So last week, at a joint board meeting with MassDOT and the MBTA's Fiscal Management Control Board, Transportation Secretary Stephanie Pollack said that the state's focus right now is on highway construction and commuter rail layover space, not on public transit services, changes, or additions.
This is not a service planning exercise. We have no idea what service will be in 2040. Right now, the service we run is the Framingham line and the bus routes that Jeff showed you. That's it.
Well, we invited both Secretary Pollack and the MBTA to participate in today's conversation. They both declined. But joining us is Jim Aloisi. He's former transportation secretary for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts and a principal at the Pemberton Square Group. He's written a lot about West Station. We have links to that at radioboston.org. Jim, it's good to see you again.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Wendy Landman. She's executive director of Walk Boston and a member of the Alston I-90 Interchange Task Force. Wendy, it's good to have you as well.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And I just want to throw a number out to listeners here, because do you travel through the Alston area on your commute? I mean, should the state be making West Station a priority Do you agree with Secretary Pollack that maybe we ought to wait till we know what the transportation needs of 2040 are before we build a new station like that, or not? Are we missing a golden opportunity here? I want to hear from you. You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Jim, so let me start with you. You do not like the fact that the state says now is not the time. Why?
Well, now is the time. Look in real time at what we're doing around the region in terms of transit and encouraging people to use transit. We didn't build the Silver Line after the Seaport District was built out. We built it before. We didn't build the Orange Line station at Assembly Square after Assembly Square was built out. We built it before. The way you build transit is to build it before the development, not after. Now, we can talk about whether there's ridership or not. The answer is there is ridership. There will be ridership. And if you build it, they will come.
I was just going to say, whatever happened to that?
This has happened to us in real time at Boston Landing, the commuter rail station that people are familiar with, and happens everywhere else. Look, to wait a generation to build West Station means a lot of things. It means that we're condemning everybody, every listener who lives in Metro West or in the Worcester area who needs to drive into Boston on a congested turnpike has no realistically viable rail alternative other than the commuter rail that's failing them every day. West Station being built early in connection with some other improvements to that line can give those people the opportunity they need to access jobs in places like jobs-rich Kendall Square in downtown Boston. To wait a generation to build West Station, which is really what we're talking about, is an unheard-of drag on bringing sustainable mobility to the urban core.
Well, so Wendy Lehman, let me get your view here because you're a member of the Alston I-90 Interchange Task Force. You heard that tape we played earlier of Secretary Pollack saying that they're really focused on the needs of drivers and highways right now.
Well, I think the task force started talking about West Station at the very first meeting that we had, and we've talked about it at every meeting since. I think the degree of support in that task force and from everybody we've heard, from the close to 500 letters that were written to MEPA in response to the state's draft environmental impact report, there is just a surge of interest in the station. And I think to turn the discussion a little bit to what it means, when we look at the Seaport District, there's a lot of disappointment that it doesn't feel as pedestrian friendly and as integrated a piece of the city as it should be. And that has transit, not as good as it should be, but it has some transit. The idea of building an entire new neighborhood and really getting it going without transit sets the stage for something that I think is not going to end up where we want to be.
So, you know, as both of you know, here on this show, we've talked so much year after year. And that's because, you know, people in Massachusetts talk about this, about the need to build a 21st century transportation infrastructure for the Commonwealth. One would think that this Alston plan presents a golden opportunity for us to say, here's what we envision as a 21st century important transportation node for Greater Boston. So what kind of vision is the state putting forth then?
Well, excuse me, it's not a sustainable mobility vision. If we're going to – I wrote a piece that's up in Commonwealth Magazine today, and I basically said we have an opportunity here, once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, to take a site that historically has been auto-centric and industrial, rail, and automobile-use wasteland, and to transform it into a multimodal ecosystem that responds to how people want to move and live today, to have a station that's vibrant and that connects people to jobs, to have walking and cycling and other transit connections that provide people with the kind of mobility we know that in this city today and in the future people want. We're going to tell everyone who's alive today they've got to wait a full generation for something to happen there. And that is a recipe, I think, for disaster, because we're looking backward, not forward. We need to be looking at sites like West State, like Alston Landing, and thinking that these are the opportunities we must grab a hold of today in order to prepare for a better future.
Yeah. Wendy, go ahead.
No, I wholeheartedly agree with what Jim just said. And I think that, again, has been what the task force has been saying since the first day. Please don't look at this. This is not a highway rebuilding project. This is a community building project, and it needs to be inclusive of all transportation modes, and it needs to be inclusive of the relationships that people who come to live and work in Boston have with the natural environment, the Charles River, with the existing neighborhoods. It's a way to re-knit the city.
Yeah.
And I think we're disappointed that we seem to be headed in a direction that says this isn't a highway replacement project when
right.
it shouldn't be.
Right. I mean, it's so massive that it shouldn't just be limited to that sort of perspective, I think.
Exactly.
So I just want to sort of explore here whether or not we're also trapped in kind of a somewhat typical Massachusetts bureaucratic knot here, because Transportation Secretary Pollack did say at that joint board meeting that I referenced earlier that when it comes to deciding, you know, what kind of services to add and therefore, you know, what kind of station and infrastructure we need, that really that's up to the MBTA. Here's what she said.
What we're trying to do is not punt and not say that the questions are the wrong questions, but we're trying to say they belong in MBTA-led service planning exercises, because ultimately the T will have to decide if they're going to run yeah. those services.
So we reached out to the T about this specifically today, and MBTA spokesman Joe Pesaturo sent us back a response saying, the types of service planning that the secretary referred to would come after many of other more fundamental decisions about exactly where, exactly when, and with what specific design elements a West Station would be built. With those decisions in place, a planning process would be needed to determine the optimal mix and types of services to run. So the state's saying it's up to the T saying it's up to it's up to the state. The hands are not talking to each other, Jim.
Well, they may be. They're probably talking to each other. They're just not getting their selves coordinated. Look,
I don't know how you get how you come to a good decision with this these two perspectives right
well,
now.
Well, you can't. And so, I think we all in the advocate community need to be very clear and precise, saying we can't squander this opportunity. People coming from Metro West and Worcester looking to access jobs here. There's a reason why Microsoft and Google and Draper Labs all have letters in to the Secretary of Environmental Affairs saying, we want West Station now. There's a reason for that. They want to give people access to jobs. And we have conversations all the time in Massachusetts about regional equity, mm-hmm. about social equity, and the connections to transit. If you don't build West Station in the short term, you have turned your back on regional equity and you've turned your back on social equity, because as we're displacing people outside of Boston, they need to come back into the city to access jobs. Nodes like West Station help them do it. So if we're serious about regional and social equity, and if we're serious about sustainable mobility, providing people with alternatives to driving their vehicles in and out of the city, we've got to improve the commuter rail system to a more regional rail system, as I've talked about before.
Yep.
And we've got to build stations like West Station, which can be a true spark for something really exciting happening at Alston Landing.
So, but Wendy, let me just come back to the fact that it seems as if that MassDOT and the T are they on the same page about this or not? It's not clear to me.
Well, of course, we're sitting outside those agencies.
Yeah.
We certainly think that they should be talking with each other. In fact, they are all under the umbrella of MassDOT. They
right.
are a unified agency. I think it's a disconnect that is probably based in the way that they functioned for many years when they weren't so connected and hasn't quite come to full fruition. I think Jim's probably in a better position than I am to answer that question, since he sat at the agency when this was happening. It's a big and complicated set of decision-making, but it certainly seems from the outside like that conversation should be completed internally. But it is something that has happened for years, that some of the planning for transit has happened under the MassDOT umbrella rather than in the MBTA umbrella. And it seems at this point to be continuing to some degree.
Enlighten me, Jim.
Look, I think honestly the answer you received makes it seem much more complicated than in fact it is, right? There is leadership at the FMCB and there's leadership at the T, and that leadership decides these things, pure and simple. And those are one and the same.
But they're not. But they're saying that they're not being the deciding force.
Well, I
here.
Understand that.
Okay, something for us to follow up on Radio Boston. We've got this comment on Twitter. M.A. Williams is telling us that we need a bunch of transit in that area. The Innovation District is going in, and all of us whose offices are moving there in 2020 need to be able to get to work. We also need to cross town. Need cross town transit to that area from the west. We don't want to have to buy a second car to get from JP to Alston. Transform that area so we can work quickly. Wendy, what do you think?
I think the comment is absolutely correct. Again, from the very beginning, we've been saying we need transit across the site, that is buses or some form of bus transit that connects, for example, from Harvard Square and Alston to the Longwood Medical area, that's a piece of that would go through West Station that would connect with the rail that West Station would provide. And we've also been talking about walking and biking connections throughout that actually connect to the river, that connect the area, the two parts of Alston that have long been divided by the railroad tracks and the highway. So this is really an opportunity to create that. And I agree completely that we need to think about that in the planning for the area and to include it in West Station.
All right. So M.A. Williams talked about the innovation area, but I think she was referring to, or he or she, whoever M.A. is, but that Harvard is developing the site there, dozens and dozens of acres, right? And Secretary Pollack said that I want to do West Station when it makes sense to do West Station. For me, it's not about arbitrary years. It's about when the development happens that generates what we need to serve. Now, if I understand correctly, Harvard has committed to making some kind of interim station by 2025. Is that right?
Harvard has committed to funding partially an early phase West Station.
About $8 million.
About $8 million. Yeah, okay. Not a lot of money. But look, no one's asking anybody to build the final comprehensive full build out West Station tomorrow. If we had a commitment to build an early phase West Station that began to set a marker for this thing, a lot of us would say that's an achievement. Let's move on. Maybe that's where we'll end up at the end of the day. But deferring the building of any transit facility at Alston Landing for a full generation, I won't even tell you how old I'll be in 2040, is a mistake. It's a generational mistake, and it's the kind of mistake that you don't get a second chance at fixing once you've made it.
Yeah. So I want to play another piece of tape here from Secretary Pollack, because I mentioned at the very, very top of our conversation that the state is also concerned about layover space for trains that are already running. And Secretary Pollack did raise concerns about the fact that a new commuter rail stop would be nice for the future. I believe she also said there's a current need for layover space with trains that are already running, right?
Well, we don't need layover space if we can move trains more frequently off-peak during the day. That's part of the issue here. If we're going to give people better inner-city rail service, let's not let them sit idle at a layover station that prevents other good things from happening. Let's have them moving all day long and give people an opportunity to get to and from places sustainably.
Okay, so I wanted to play what...
I'm sorry.
That's all right. I want to just play the tape that Secretary Pollack and why she said she has these concerns.
The Worcester line was built with insufficient layover. It doesn't have enough layover today, let alone in the future.
I
understand why the community wants the station first. The T wants layover first. It actually has layover in its five-year capital budget. It doesn't have service.
Wendy, I just want to know what your take is on this.
Well, again, I want to endorse what Jim said.
Yeah.
And I think, importantly, Jim is part of an organization called Transit Matters that put out a really interesting report on regional rail, which talks about running the system not as simply commute in the morning, commute out in the evening, but actually running our commuter rail infrastructure as a regional rail system that provides service all day. Keolis is interested in that. They've been talking about it themselves. They've been exploring some of the very same things that Transit Matters has explored. And by the way, the MBTA is also studying that. So I think it's really short-sighted to think about storing trains rather than using trains.
Yeah.
And I think that's sort of the setup, that using this valuable space just to have the trains sit there as opposed to actually using them in a way that provides more service for more people. And I think Jim's absolutely right about that.
So we have less than a minute to go. I just want to ask you a dollars and cents question. So we said that the whole development is roughly $1 billion, right? And that would include West Station in 2040, but ostensibly, right? But I mean, I think estimates I'm seeing of the total cost just for West Station would be between $89 to $96 million. I mean, bringing that forward, where does the state have the money for that now, Jim? We just got about 30 seconds.
So we think it a lot of us who are looking at this carefully think that's a very inflated number, that first of all. Secondly, as I say in my piece in Commonwealth today, the state's about to spend an additional $100 to $175 million to replace the elevated turnpike as an elevated highway,
right,
as
rather
opposed
than
to
grade.
An at grade.
Right.
So yeah. There's money if we want to use money. It's just the question of, do we want to do it?
Well, Jim Aloisi is the former Transportation Secretary for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. He's a principal at the Pemberton Square Group. And we'll link to your piece. That's in Commonwealth Magazine. We'll put a link to it at RadioBoston.org. Jim, thanks a lot. And Wendy Landman, Executive Director of Walk Boston and a member of the Alston I-90 Interchange Task Force, thank you as well.
Thank you. Glad you had us on.
Well, that's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.